The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Connolly, Judge Reyes, Judge Hallbrooks, the Honorable Francis J. Connolly presiding.
Thank you and good morning. Our first case this morning is case file number A20-0656, Jesse Stoltenberg versus American National Property and Casualty. The first thing I just want to confirm is both Mr. Ahrens and Ms. Olson, can you both see and hear us? All right, you're nodding your heads, yes. Then as all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. Ms. Olson will have 15 minutes for her argument. And then finally, Mr. Ahrens will have 5 minutes rebuttal. So whenever you're ready, just unmute yourself. And Mr. Ahrens, you may begin.
Good morning, panel. Thank you for the opportunity to present this case in front of you justices. This is a case of a first impression at the Court of Appeals involving the interpretation of a drop-down or step-down clause contained within my client American National's policy of insurance that was issued to its named insured, Jeff Belstad. The respondent, Ms. Stoltenberg, was unrelated undisputably to Mr. Belstad by blood, marriage, or adoption. And it's our contention, panel, that the Court of Appeals should reverse the district court order denying our motion for summary judgment, entering a cross motion for summary judgment in favor of Ms. Stoltenberg, and declaring that she is entitled to $250,000 in available UIM coverage under the policy of insurance.
Yes. Question for you right off the bat. Sorry to interrupt you. It's always awkward when we're not in person. To say this is a case of first impression, could you articulate what the question is that is involved in this, you know, given Canadian Universal and Benton, why is this a case of first impression?
Because it involves an individual who's not a named insured or policy holder, where she is claiming under the law that she is required to have the notice to Mr. Belstad or apply to her, where the notice clearly went to Mr. Belstad. It didn't reduce any UIM coverage for him. He paid for what he received. He received $250,000 worth of UIM coverage. That was not reduced. It was only reduced by virtue of the fact that she is not related to Mr. Belstad by blood, marriage, or adoption. Case law is clear in that all that is required under Canadian Universal is that the insurer provide notice to the insured, the named insured, or the policyholder. And that's where it's an issue of first impression, where Ms. Stoltenberg is trying to claim that the notice should be applied to her status as only a vehicle occupant. She always is entitled to purchase excess underinsured motorist benefit limits of higher coverage under the law pursuant to
Ahrens.
Yes.
If I can interrupt, I don't, and I'm sure Ms. Olson can make her own arguments, but I don't think Ms. Olson is suggesting that her client needed to get the notice. That goes to insured. But I think she is suggesting that why shouldn't she get the benefit of the policy if your client, if the insured didn't get notice? And I guess I fail to see why she shouldn't. I mean, you know, the law is the law, and you know, she gets coverage depending on what the statute and the policy say. So why, following up on Judge Halbrook's question, why is the fact that she's not a policyholder or the named insured play any difference as to whether or not you know, the notice provision applies?
The notice provision still does apply when there's a reduction My argument is that there wasn't a substantial reduction in the insured or the named insured or policyholders benefits or UIM benefits here in this case. But regardless, even assuming that there was a substantial reduction, American National, my client, provided the adequate notice to its named insured, Jeff Belstad, and it complied with the requirements set forth in Canadian Universal and its progeny. Those cases cited in our briefs, and specifically, it provided Mr. Belstad with the endorsement itself. That's all that's required under Canadian Universal.
I'm going to stop you for 1 second again. Very sorry to be interrupting your train of thought, but before we leave substantial reduction, because I assume more of your argument may be focused on the adequacy of notice, but what guidance can you give us with respect to how one gauges what is a substantial reduction in benefit? What authority can you cite that upholds your position with this?
Well, our position is clear under the case law is that there was no substantial reduction in underinsured motorist benefits to the named insured, Jeff Belstad.
Okay. Go ahead.
Yes, Your Honor. It only reduced coverage to those unrelated to the named insured or policyholder by blood, marriage, or adoption. And it defined in the endorsement itself what the limits were, and that those limits were those required under the state financial responsibility law, and under our Minnesota No Fault Act, it is a minimum of $25,000, which is exactly what case law has held, that there is no ambiguity, there is no hidden exclusion if you define the terms of the insurance or the minimal limits by virtue of referring to the state financial responsibility law.
Mr. Irons, can I stop right there? Because I think you're going to the second issue of whether it was clear. And I noticed in your brief, and in particular in your reply brief, that you make the argument that it was clear to respondent what the minimum limits were. And then you have in parenthetical, i.e., comma, $25,000. Did the policy explicitly state that the policy for somebody who is unrelated would be dropping from $250,000 to $25,000?
No, it did not.
Okay, so if it didn't, I think it's rather interesting that not only do you spell that out in your brief, both in your main brief and your reply brief, but the policy language, you actually underline key provisions, but those provisions were never underlined in the policy itself, and that substantial drop from 250,000 to 25,000 is never stated anywhere. I looked it over back and forth and I couldn't find that anywhere. So I'm glad you confirmed that. So why is that, it appears to be insufficient notice to the policyholder of what actually is happening?
Actually, under existing case law, I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. And we've cited those cases. Drop-down provisions have been uniformly upheld by not only this court, but the Eighth Circuit. We cite those.
But that's a different issue. You're talking about whether or not a drop-down policy is permissible. The issue here is a different issue than those cases, including the Eighth Circuit cases. Here, the issue is whether or not there's sufficient notice given to the policyholder of the change. And I see in that policy, quite frankly, a lot of, you know, happy language, so to speak, we're doing the best we can for you and we're making some changes to the language. But I don't see anything indicating, FYI, you're going from $250,000 to $25,000 in terms of coverage, but you're still paying the same amount.
And Your Honor, case law in my interpretation and reading of that as long as you define the minimal limits by reference to the state financial responsibility law, which American National, my client, did, and that being the minimal limits, even though you don't state the minimal limits, that has been upheld uniformly to comply with requirements of step down or drop down provisions. So far, there hasn't been any case that states specifically you have to identify the amount of coverage. One of the cases we cite, the Babinski, the Eighth Circuit, dropped from $1 million to $30,000 in coverage, even though that wasn't specifically identified. And so getting back to the main argument that even assuming there was a substantial reduction in coverage, under the holding of Universal or Canadian Universal, American National did provide the adequate notice. And they had three ways in which to do it, which was a letter, the endorsement with conspicuous heading, and or some other means or similar means. American National undisputedly provided the endorsement, which has been approved by the Department of Commerce, Division of Insurance, and it's stayed the same for the last 14 years. Every time there's been a substantial change, they submit it to the Department of Commerce.
Again, Mr. Arons, that seems to be off point in terms of whether whether a department approves of it. I have two questions along those lines. Did the department analyze it under the Canadian Universal case law? And second, the other cases you cite, including the Eighth Circuit, did they apply the Canadian Universal analysis?
No, they were determining whether or not, well, let me answer that question first. There's no indication that the Department of Commerce Division of Insurance applied or analyzed under the Canadian Universal holding. Second, the case law construing drop-down or step-down clauses didn't deal necessarily with notice provisions with regard to the substantial reduction. What it did say was that, again, these have been upheld so long as they're unambiguous. And in the Babinski situation, it was nearly identical to the clause contained within my client, American National's policy of insurance, and it has been in the policy for the last approximately 14 years without any substantial change. Case law is clear that an insured has an obligation and a duty, quite frankly, to read the policy, and endorsements, exclusions are a part of the contract, and the insured has a duty to read all portions of the contract.
Mr. Arons, we're getting down on time. I want to ask a question about the declarations page for the 216 policy. And this does show up in other areas. The important notice, the thing that's in all capital letters, this policy reduces the applicable limits, and it goes through bodily injury, property damage, uninsured, underinsured. But then it ends with this language: when an insured vehicle is operated by anyone other than you or a relative. And that same, you know, putting that other person, the non-related person, in the driver's seat shows up in other spots. This to me seems to really undercut the notice argument, because it directs the policyholder to think that, okay, if someone is a passenger, then these reduced limits are not applicable. What is your response to that?
Well, there are other provisions within that renewal packet, if you will, that specifically state that the limits for underinsured motorists are...
I will grant you that. And I'm sorry to interrupt you, but because you've only got about a minute. Yes, that is true. But this is in all caps. It leads the deck page. And at a minimum, it's certainly inconsistent and confusing for a policyholder. Would you not agree?
Well, I wouldn't agree that it is confusing if you read the policy as a whole and you specifically read the endorsement, which is separate and apart from the renewal packet, and the endorsement is part of the policy. That is the policy, and the endorsement has complied with Minnesota law and what has been determined to be in compliance with Minnesota law in terms of defining what the limits are, or the minimal limits under the state financial responsibility law, that being $25,000 for UM, or in this case, underinsured motorist coverage. And I see we're short on time, so I'll save the remainder for the rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Ahrens. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. We'll now hear for counsel for the respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Jenny Olson, and I represent the respondent, Jesse Stoltenberg. The ultimate question, or the 50,000-foot view question, the court has to decide is what amount of underinsured motorist coverage is available to Ms. Stoltenberg on Mr. Ballstead's policy. She's required under Minnesota statute to go to his policy first for underinsured motorist coverage, and there's no dispute in this case that the policy that Mr. Ballstead purchased and paid premiums for in 1997 offered underinsured motorist coverage to all insureds up to the amount of coverage in the declarations page. Because ANPAC tried to reduce that coverage through an amendatory endorsement, we have to look to the Canadian Universal case to determine if that endorsement ever went into effect. Now, Mr. Ahrens repeatedly discusses the obligation of the policyholder to read things or do things, and those are all things that you will see in cases talking about the initial insurance contract and what the duties are. But Canadian Universal is addressing a very specific problem, and that's the conduct of an insurance company. And that's the conduct of offering a policy of insurance that has a particular type and amount of coverage, accepting premiums for that policy, and then later changing or reducing the coverage through a renewal or an endorsement. And so what we look at to determine what the Canadian Universal Standard is doing is we look at the conduct of the insurance company, not the obligation of the insured. And there's two sub-questions here the court has to answer. One is—
Wilson, I'd sort of like to get right to the notice issue.
Okay.
So I assume you would agree with me that, you know, the insurance company can either send a letter or they can highlight it in the endorsements. Would that be a fair statement?
I disagree, Your Honor. They can send a cover letter or there can be a conspicuous heading on the endorsement. It's not the language of the endorsement itself that puts the insured on notice. In every single case that this court has looked at in the notice requirement, there was an unambiguous reduction of coverage somewhere in an endorsement or a renewal. For example, in Canadian Universal itself, it agreed with the district court that the exclusion in the endorsement was unambiguous. But the question is whether that change was brought to the attention of the insured. And you can do that by, one, sending a cover letter that brings to the attention of the insured the reduction, or a conspicuous heading. So I would advise the court not to look to the language itself.
Well, but what does the conspicuous heading have to say? I assume you're saying the conspicuous heading that says important information regarding your policy is not enough?
Correct, Your Honor.
What should it have said?
Important information, this amendatory endorsement reduces coverage in your policy. Because the court's been crystal clear that this isn't a notice in general issue. In Benton, the court said that the letter provided notice that it contained information and changes to the insured's accident and disability policy. However, it did not bring to the attention of the insured that it was a reduction in the coverage. We also see in the Horace Mann case that this—
What about the language, and I understand you're saying it's not in the heading, but you know, it does say, please note the reduced limits of liability for permissive viewers of your insured vehicle. do not apply to your liabilities. You're saying that's not enough because why? It should have said, you know, there are reduced limits of liability for permissive users. And by God, it's dropping from 250 to 25,000.
Your Honor, I'm sorry to do this, but can you point me to where you're pointing to in the language? Because I'm looking at the first page of the amendatory endorsement, and the header only contains a statement that this endorsement changes your policy. Please read carefully. So are you further down?
I'm looking at the notice document titled Important Information Regarding Your Policy, the fourth document in the packet.
Okay, in the renewal packet itself?
Yeah.
Okay, Your Honor. Yep. And
so that's not enough.
No, Your Honor, and particularly the renewal packet itself has a whole separate area of law that analyzes these renewal packets. And the court has been very clear that sandwiching this type of language, even if it's unambiguous, into a renewal packet or a promotional looking letter is not enough. And so if we look at this renewal packet, we see that that letter that actually addresses the change isn't until 9 pages in. An insured would have to go through the insurance cards. The first substantive portion of the renewal packet is the declarations page. And that's where any reasonable insured would go to look and see if their coverage has been changed or altered. And this declarations page gives no notice of a reduction in coverage. There's absolutely no notice that there's a reduction in the premiums being paid or anything that would alert the insured. Then they have to go through all this promotional material about easy pay and how great it is, and then other promotional material about how great the AMPAC coverage is and that they're striving to provide you the best coverage. And the law is clear. We do not require insureds to go through all of that promotional material in order to find something on the 9th page that would say there might be a reduction in coverage. And the court in the Horace Mann and the Benton cases criticized notices. In Benton, it was the 2nd page of the letter, and they said that's not prominently placed. In Horace Mann, it was the 3rd page of a brochure. They said that's not good enough. So there's no reason that this court should conclude the 9th page of a promotional packet is adequate notice under the law. And in terms of the adequate notice, I just want to be really clear about what AMPAC is asking this court to do. They have not cited to any distinguishing fact in this renewal packet from renewal packets and letters and headers that this court has found were not adequate notice. So when they point to the renewal packet, which is a promotional letter, this court has said that's not good enough. When they point to the please read carefully language in the header, this court has said that's not good enough. It might be notice, but not of a reduction. And so what they're asking you to do without distinguishing this case is essentially to overrule a line of cases that has protected insureds in Minnesota since 1977. There is no distinction that would allow this court to say that this particular renewal packet or heading is different than the cases that where the court found the notice was inadequate. And AMPAC shouldn't be asking this court to tacitly change the law. This is an error correcting court. The district court properly outlined the Canadian Universal Standard, properly cited the cases addressing notice, compared the facts of this case, the notice here, to those notices that were found not to be valid, and there's no legal error to correct here.
Ms. Olson, could you speak to the argument that this is not a substantial reduction in coverage because your client was not the named insured or the policyholder?
Yes, Your Honor. So my understanding of AMPAC's argument is that this court should overturn the district court's decision because that's somehow an expansion of Canadian Universal because she's not a named insured or a policyholder. And there's a legal and a real practical answer to your question. I'd hope to get to both. As a legal matter, we're told by Canadian Universal that this rule is regulating conduct of the insurance company, changing coverage after it's purchased. And there's no legal hook to say that that conduct of changing coverage after it's purchased when applied to to a named policyholder is conduct that we don't allow in this state. But if it's an insured under contract or policy, just not the named insured, well, then that conduct is no longer something that needs to be addressed. It's just practically, it doesn't make sense, and there's no hook for it in the case law. We're trying to stop a particular type of conduct by the insurance company. Second, there's a real practical answer to that question. Insureds do not buy individual slices of an insurance policy or product. They buy a policy. That policy covers them in some instances. It covers their family in some instances. It covers passengers in their vehicle, people on their property. That's a product as a whole. And the district court, I think, really hit the nail on the head when addressing this and said, this particular coverage may be more or less important to individual insureds, but it's the insured's decision to make. They need to be put on notice of that. AMPAC seems to admit that if Ms. Stoltenberg was his wife, that would be a substantial reduction in coverage because she's a blood relative of the named, or by marriage to the named insured. But simply because she's his live-in partner and they've chosen to build a life together outside of marriage, all of a sudden that's not important in terms of the insuring decision. And I think on a practical level, that just doesn't make sense. Canadian Universal is saying, you need to put these reductions in front of the insured so they can make the choice about whether to keep the coverage based on what's important to them. And individual insured should be able to look at this and say, maybe I don't have a problem with reducing coverage to passengers, but that might be a real big problem for someone else. And they should have the right to go on the market and purchase the insurance that they thought they were buying initially.
Thank you.
In addition, with regard to the substantial reduction in coverage, I would ask the court to look at the cases that really hone down on what a substantial reduction in coverage is. We know from this court that there's a line between procedural and substantive reductions in coverage. In Samuelson, UIM, underinsured motorist provision, where it changed from a arbitration provision to a litigation provision, but the type and amount of coverage was the exact same, the court said that's not a substantial reduction. But once we get outside of that procedural context and we look at substantive reductions, every case that I have found in this court addressing a substantive reduction in the type or amount of coverage has said that is substantial. If we look at the Bast versus Capital Indemnity case, I think there's a good example of this. In Bast, the property owner, mortgagee, had a policy that changed from initially being replacement value of property to actual cash value. And the court had determined the property damage under actual cash value was about $6,000. The court never went and looked at, well, what would be the replacement value, and drew a line saying $50 is enough, $1,000 is enough. They simply said that there was a potential that the difference between replacement and cash value could be significant, and therefore it's a substantial reduction in coverage. So the court has taken a broad view that if something is substantive in terms of type and amount of coverage, that will be found to be a substantive reduction. And that really doesn't support this distinction AMPAC attempts to make between named insureds and insureds under the policy. AMPAC's argument also seems to imply that Ms. Stoltenberg is some kind of random person in this transaction. And I would like to point to the court to the fact that Ms. Stoltenberg's not just an insured by statute, she's an insured under AMPAC's policy. They specifically define her as an insured. And so she is part of the product of insurance. She is someone who's covered by this product of insurance. And something that drastically reduces her coverage from $225,000 to $25,000 under any case you look at would be a substantial reduction in coverage. Your Honors, I see I'm closing in on my time here. And so if there's no further questions, I'd just like to wrap up and say that in this case, the district court's order correctly identifies the law. It correctly applies the law to the facts. The criticisms that AMPAC lodges at the district court order of the district court's order don't have a footing in case law. For example, there's this attack on the financial responsibility laws. AMPAC cites two cases on an initial contracting matter to try to undermine that. But the Benton case specifically says you have to put the change in limits in front of the insured. And so that means the amount of coverage. And AMPAC repeatedly looks to different areas of case law and particularly foundations of initial contracting to try to undermine the district court's order. But this is a specific issue with a renewal and a reduction of coverage. And there is no law and no facts to support AMPAC's proposition that there's an error of fact or law in this decision. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. Olson. Mr. Ahrens, you'll have the last word, sir.
Thank you, panel. Quite frankly, the renewal packet that was sent, and we can agree to disagree or argue whether or not whatever is contained within the new renewal packet was sufficient, but the fact remains that's a red herring. What was required under Canadian Universal, Judge Conley, as you pointed out, is sending the endorsement. The endorsement controls. That is what was required. That, in fact, was sent. That has been sent each and every policy renewal since September of 2005. It clearly had the conspicuous language stating that this endorsement changes your policy. Please read that carefully. And that language would have to comply with the Department of Commerce Division of Insurance. There are specific font requirements, bold requirements. That complies with the requirements under the Department of Commerce. So it's a red herring to talk about, in my opinion, the renewal packet when the endorsement was all that was required to be sent to comply with Canadian Universal. It was sent to Mr. Ahrens,
I'm looking at I assume you're referring to the amendatory endorsement SA-472?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Would you point to me the exact language that says the coverage has dropped from 250,000 to 25,000? And more importantly, the language that specifically says, oh, and by the way, you know, it's different if you're not a family member.
The endorsement specifically clearly delineates drop down or step down language. It says this endorsement itself states this endorsement changes your policy. Please read it carefully. The drop down provision also contains bold face all cap font indicating quote unquote limits of liability for the named insured, a relative, or a person related to the named insured by blood, marriage, or adoption, and for any other person. Minnesota case law is clear that insurers can have different limits of insurance for different classes of individuals. Certainly, it would be a stretch for this court to conclude that Stoltenberg, just by virtue of the fact that she's an insured on a policy, which is not disputed, but that she had to be provided with the notice. But again, the case law, as I indicated in the briefs, is clear that you can refer to the drop-down limits and the minimal limits that are required under the state financial responsibility law. So does it state specifically that it reduces coverage to any other occupant of the vehicle not related by blood, marriage, or adoption from 250,000 to 25,000? No, but that's not what is required under the holding of Canadian Universal. again, Ms. Stoltenberg and by all means could have purchased additional excess insurance coverage under the law that's permitted, and in the amendments to the No Fault Act back in 1985, which was set forth in the holding in the Becker case, it allows individuals to protect themselves for specifically these types of situations, to protect themselves and family members by purchasing excess UIM or UM insurance coverage that is above and beyond what is contained in the vehicle that they are riding in at the time of the accident. Your Honor.
Mr. Aarons, that sort of misses the point. I mean, the point is, perhaps you would have purchased insurance had they known how low these limits were, but you know, they didn't. They assumed they had 250.
They certainly had the opportunity and the obligation and duty to read their policy. And the policy was clear in what it provided.
But Mr. Aarons, it is true also that you actually have to look outside of the policy to determine what the new policy limit is, correct?
You can refer to it by the endorsement, and the
there's nothing in your answer to Judge Connolly. There's nothing in there that says it goes down to $25,000. That is not spelled out in the policy. You actually have to look outside of the policy to get that number, right?
That is true, and that has been upheld in the cases that we cite.
You keep citing the cases that haven't applied the Canadian standard, though.
But the reduction in coverage from a certain level of coverage down to minimal limits has been upheld, and there is no requirement in Canadian Universal or any of the other cases that require the insurer to set forth the specific amount that the coverage is being reduced to. The cases Ms. Olson cites, the Benton, the Horace Mann, those are clearly distinguishable, and the district court, the Honorable Judge Janisch, distinguished those cases in her district court order. That's why this case.
Thank you, Mr. Aarons. I think we've given you a little more time, so I am going to cut you off now. Thank you, Ms. Olson. We appreciate the thoroughness of the briefs that you written, and you will receive our decision in 90 days. Thank you.